Hello again. I'm Stephen Saunders, an associate lecturer at the University of Central Florida. I'm a licensed psychologist and have been in practice since 1998. These podcasts are from a series of lectures I give in my teaching capacity at UCF. Copyright 2019, all rights reserved. If you'd like to contact me, you may do so at wstephensaunders@ucf.edu or call me at 352-406-0506. Enjoy the podcast. Ancient Mesopotamia, going back to the Sumerians, even had a clear recognition of mental health problems. The Chinese, the Egyptians, the Hebrews, the Greeks, all in ancient times, looked at abnormal behavior as due to possession by good or evil spirits. Sometimes they meant that literally, but and sometimes if you read the writings, you can infer what they were really talking about. They were using spiritual language to discuss psychological phenomena. It was just a metaphor or a way to understand that. Sometimes it isn't, though. Sometimes they were talking about it literally. You know, there are people who are very religious today that still believe this on some level. And one of the hardest things in the world about being a psychologist or really any mental health professional is that everyone thinks they are one too. And I'll give you a good example. My sweet mama called me up a few years ago, right smack dab in the middle of the Casey Anthony trial. Y'all remember Casey Anthony, all the big hullabaloo about that here in Central Florida. Well, mama called me and she goes, "Steve, honey, it's so good to talk to you. Listen, Shug, I got to tell you something real important. And I want to get your opinion. You're a doctor of psychology, and you've got all that education, and I figured that maybe you would know something about this. But what do you think about that Casey Anthony? What's the deal with her?" So I thought suddenly, oh, this is my chance. Right. I'm finally going to prove to Mama that all her hard work and money to send me through college and school and graduate school has paid off. So for the next 15 minutes, I launched into a very intelligent, very erudite, very psychological explanation of what I thought was Casey Anthony's complete psychological profile. When I was finished, I was so satisfied with myself, and I stopped and I paused, and Mama goes, "Well, that's real interesting, but let me tell you what I think." And I'm like, okay, and then you realize Mama thinks that her opinion is just as valid as my professional opinion. Now, if I was a cardiologist and I told Mama, "Mama, you got a heart murmur," Mama's not going to say, "Well, let me tell you what I think," right? Oh, okay. No, she's going to accept that as fact. But that's the problem when you're dealing with mental health professionals, because often, you know, our own world, our own subjective world, is a world we're constantly living in and with. We all have an opinion about what makes ourselves tick, as well as what makes others tick. And so, you know, that's the difficult thing about being a mental health professional. You're still having to deal with everyone's opinion about all this stuff. Hippocrates, the ancient Greek physician, proposed that mental disorders had natural causes, which was a big deal during this era. Categorized disorders as mania, melancholia, which is like depression, and phrenitis, associated dreams and personality together. You know, he really kind of laid the foundation for early empirical treatments or thoughts about psychology. Plato viewed psychological phenomena as responses of the whole organism and emphasized individual differences and socio-cultural differences. He even discussed hospital care. The ancient Greeks had places where you could go to get care. Aristotle wrote lasting descriptions of consciousness and thinking as directed would eliminate pain and even help you to attain more pleasure by thinking the right thoughts. Interesting. You know, in some ways, that's really what cognitive behavioral psychology is. You have a thought disorder. You are thinking the wrong thoughts. Let me help you think the correct thoughts. Therefore, you will, you know, get better in some ways. The Egyptians proposed a whole wide range of therapeutic measures. The ancient Egyptians really were quite advanced in a lot of areas, including all kinds of areas in medicine, what they were doing with prosthetics. They were making prosthetic arms and legs. They were making even bridges for teeth and dentures. There's even some evidence that ancient Egyptians had gotten to the point where they were actually doing cataract surgery, believe it or not. It was really fascinating. And a lot of the different ancients proposed a lot of different ways at looking at things. Now, what's interesting about the Chinese Eastern medicine is very different in its orientation from Western medicine. Eastern medicine is much more focused on functional aspects of physiology rather than physiological aspects. You know, you think about Western medicine looks at you like a car, and the doctor is the mechanic. I'm going to diagnose the problem, and then I'm going to fix you. Where the Eastern doctor looks at you as more of a whole being, and there's a functional issue with you, let me help your body come back into function in some ways. Part of that is because Eastern culture had a strict prohibition against desecrating bodies. Even though the West did as well, there was more of a tolerance for doing autopsies and taking dead bodies apart and learning about what's going on with this inside. You know, what is the function of the lungs? What's the function of the liver? What's the function of the kidneys? What are all these parts named and what do they do? Eastern medicine only did that with live people and only through functional means, or they had a kind of a functional understanding of all that. So they incorporated ideas for Western psychiatry really as just over the last 50 years, it kind of got incorporated. It's really interesting though, if you really study Buddhism, particularly mindfulness, which is kind of a form of Buddhist meditation that's been around for centuries, you will find that a lot of Buddhist practices are more of a psychology and knowing how to help the mind and help the your outlook on life and all of those things rather than necessarily religion. It's quite fascinating, and I don't think that Eastern ways should be discounted. There's a lot of helpful things from those cultures. The Middle East had a scientific approach in the Middle Ages. Europe often was plagued with mass madness and treatment, including exorcism. And there was a fear of witchcraft. I think she's a witch.
She's a witch!
Right? And they had this interesting way of determining whether or not you were a witch. They would tie you to some stones, and if you floated, then you were a witch because people couldn't normally float with stones tied to them, and therefore you were burned at the stake. However, if you went to the bottom of the lake with the stones on you, then you weren't a witch, and of course you died still, but thankfully your soul was welcomed into heaven. Because you obviously weren't a witch, and then they apologized to the family. Sorry. Well, I swear we thought she was a witch. Right? But she wasn't. But now we know. We wouldn't have known if we had done that. So around the 17th, 18th century, the 17th century was known as the Age of Enlightenment. There was a resurgence of scientific questioning in Europe and an establishment of early asylums where mentally ill people were put to try to help to understand them. Some of them weren't necessarily to help to understand them. They were simply put there to just keep them away from the general population. It was kind of sad in some ways because in the 19th century, one of the things that Victorians loved to do in British Victorian England is on Sunday after church, you know, they would have their Sunday meal and then they would go visit the asylum. much in the same way that we go visit zoos today, to look at all the people who were crazy and all the wacky things they were doing, and that was kind of entertainment to them. You know, of course, today we would think how horrible that is, but that was kind of, in a lot of ways, kind of considered to be a thing. In the 20th century, there became changing attitudes toward mental health and really looking at it more as a disease, like everything else that we look at as a disease. And it's something that can be treated and hopefully cured, or at least help a person to become more functional. The Renaissance led to a resurgence of scientific questioning, as I said earlier, and that was part of the humanism movement. So early asylums were established in the 16th century. Madhouses, or bedlam storage places for the insane, was found throughout Europe and even parts of the United States. And there was even aggressive treatment to restore balance to the body and brain. A lot of bloodletting was going on during that time. You know, there was a thought that the humors of the body were out of balance, and that's what partly was causing the mental illness. And if you could bleed someone, you would reestablish balance in the humors, and they would get better. And it's true, if you bleed someone long enough, they're going to calm down, right? Significantly. So a lot of humanitarian reform and a lot of different thinkers during this era that helped to establish humanitarian treatment for the mentally ill. So the military really had a big role and have always had a role in psychology. One of the reasons why that is because, number one, the military has a vested interest in not having mentally ill soldiers on the battlefield. Right? If you have someone who is mentally ill on the battlefield, that could mean the difference between victory or defeat, and it certainly could mean the difference between death of your soldiers or they're coming back alive. And so even today, the military invests a lot of money into the treatment of mental disorders that soldiers encounter. One of the biggest ones that they encounter is, what do you think? PTSD, right. It's really part of popular culture. Post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, every single soldier, airman, or seaman who goes into battle doesn't necessarily develop PTSD, right? So there's a lot of research going into what makes someone susceptible to PTSD, what actually causes PTSD, and then what can we do to treat it to make them better. Germany was a developed program of military psychiatry following the Franco-Prussian War, and it contributed to the field of abnormal psychology when they actually began to diagnose and categorize different mental illnesses. In the 19th century, they had views of causes and treatments of mental disorder. There was the alienist view, which was basically that mental illness was something that occurred outside of the body, and maybe you were getting infected. Gained control of asylums. It touted Victorian morality as important to good mental health. If you were just more moral, you wouldn't be feeling all these different problems, right? Cliff Beers described On Mental Collapse as a mind that found itself, a very famous book. One of the kind of everyday sayings for mental health issues is, I had a nervous breakdown. Have you ever heard that before? I actually really like that because it's so descriptive. Even the word nervous breakdown, the words, it kind of describes, and you sort of feel what's happening to this person. Often what a person means by that is that they've had a series of panic attacks and then they've become dysfunctional, they're high anxiety, or they've had a major depressive episode of some sort. You know, or they may have even had a brief psychotic break that has caused this feeling of, like, I'm broken down. And if you've ever experienced any kind of mental health episode or been around someone who has, it certainly feels that way to people. So mental health care in the 20th century, most mental hospitals were inhumane and ineffective, unfortunately. Ward published a book called The Snake Pit, which was a critique of mental health hospitals during that era. The National Institute of Mental Health was established in 1946. That was right after World War II, to try to help and better understand mental health. In 1963, there was the Community Health Services Act that was established, and that was an attempt to deinstitutionalize people. Prior to 1963, if you thought Joe wasn't acting right, all you had to do is to go get one more person, Joe's other friend, go down to the courthouse, talk to the clerk of the court, fill out a form, Joe ain't acting right. We think he's mentally ill. Y'all need to evaluate him. Suddenly, Joe's at home minding his own business, eating breakfast, when out of nowhere, a knock at the door. Joe opens the door, and there's a couple people in white coats and a deputy sheriff. Joe, you coming with us? And Joe says, hell no, I ain't. And he starts running the other way. Well, obviously crazy, right? Because a normal person certainly wouldn't run away from someone who shows up unannounced in the middle of your breakfast to come cart you away. That's kind of how it was looked at. And a lot of studies about mental health hospitals during this era showed that psychiatrists and psychologists were pathologizing everything. Any behavior that someone who is perceived to be mentally ill, any behavior they were doing was seen as abnormal or deviant. In fact, there was a study where there was actually three psychologists who had themselves committed under false identities with a whole history of mental health issues, and they behaved completely normal while they were in the hospital. But they just had this record that said they had this history of mental health issues. And over 3 days, they documented everything that was happening to them while they were patients in the hospital. And so when they were writing their notes and documenting, the psychiatrist was writing in his file, the patient's file, patient engaging in abnormal writing behavior. Right? And so everything they were doing was seen as pathological. And so that's something that we all have to be aware of as mental health professionals. And as you come up in the mental health profession, you have to be aware of your own bias towards something. You know, sometimes when you get a series of medical records and a series of mental health records on someone, and then you go to see them, you may have already a set up an implicit bias that's called confirmation bias. Well, I already think you're crazy because I have all the records of how crazy you are. So now I'm going to look at you, and when I interview you, anything you say is going to seem crazy, right? Or anything you do will seem crazy. That's confirmation bias. So we have to be aware of that so that we don't do that, and we can look at things more objectively and with more of a scientific mind rather than through a bias. So as I said, during this period, there was a deinstitutionalization movement and trying to return the mentally ill to their communities and trying to help them in their own county or their own community they lived in. In the state of Florida, every single county in the state of Florida has what's known as a Baker Act receiving facility, where if you are in imminent danger of self-harm or harming another person, a mental health professional can have you evaluated and you sent to the hospital. Now, they are only allowed, under the Baker Act law, they are only allowed to keep you there for 3 days. And after that 3-day period, you must be released unless they can show before a judge, and they have a court hearing about this, that you are a continued danger to yourself or others. And they have to show just cause, and they have to have an evaluation and all that. And that's to protect that person's civil rights. Because as I was talking about before, prior to this 1960s, once a person was put into a state hospital, they actually could remain there for years before they were put out. And there's even evidence that happened where you would have a spouse who, instead of getting divorced, they would have them institutionalized. And so they would have them institutionalized, and they just were kept there against their will. And sometimes really nothing wrong with them. And they were shot up with drugs and given all kinds of treatments. And, you know, anybody is going to get crazy if you go through that. And sometimes the act of being hospitalized is more traumatic to the person than the illness itself. I always get clients. I am very reluctant to hospitalize someone unless I really, really feel. I always ask, on a personal level, I always ask myself, can I lay my head tonight on the pillow and be reasonably assured that when I wake up in the morning, this patient's still going to be alive? If I can't give myself a definite yes to that, then I make a serious contemplation or effort to hospitalize them. But most of the time, in fact, almost every single patient I've ever hospitalized is after a long conversation with them, and I get their consent, and they, you know, agree to participate in it. Because it's so much easier to hospitalize someone who's voluntarily going there with the police or voluntarily going there with the ambulance rather than, I ain't going, and they're screaming. And, Lord, that's the last thing you want in your office anyway. So trying to get moved toward a more humane, cost-effective way of treating people. So recent changes, there's been a lot of biological and even genetic research that have showed that there are a lot of mental illnesses that have biological causes or even genetic causes. You may all have heard about the technique called CRISPR, which actually, they're actually able to now use a molecular knife. It's actually a protein molecule where they can actually go into a person's DNA and they can turn on and off genes in your DNA, and they can cut out specific genes in your DNA. And they have actually been able to do this even with people. If they're doing it now with human embryos. There was a recent technique that they used using CRISPR that they cut out Huntington's disease out of embryos. And there were three children who had the biological markers for Huntington's disease. They were going to develop Huntington's disease, which dramatically shortens your life. They turned that gene off. They were born utterly normal. And this was about 5 years ago. Kids still normal. No biological markers for Huntington's disease. Probably will never encounter it. And so we're really moving into a new era where, in my opinion, very severe mental illnesses like schizophrenia or maybe even bipolar, we will find genetic markers for these, and they actually will be diagnosed in utero while a mother is still pregnant with this child, and they'll be able to actually manipulate the genes of this child and have them born who may have like a 50% chance of developing schizophrenia. They'll turn those off, and then they'll never develop the disease. What do you think of that? Is that a good thing, bad thing? It's a slippery slope in some ways, right? I mean, I think most people that I ask this question to, you know, agree that if you can cure or treat an illness in someone, you should, right? If you can keep a child from developing cystic fibrosis, who most kids don't live past the age of 20. That might be one of the problems too, right? And so you have, so in some ways, are we messing with our evolution? So we have people who are in the wealthy class that can afford this technology, who, you know, they're cutting out all the defective genes in their family line, right? The very poor can't afford it. So what happens to them, right? You know, yeah, that's an excellent point. Or what if we get to the point where we figure out the gene that gives someone music ability, perfect pitch, the ability to play the piano really well and has great musical ability? Well, I certainly want my daughter or my son to have that. Flip on the music gene, right? Or great intelligence, you know? We've actually found that most things that we think of as being very simple in our genome actually are not. They actually are controlled by multiple genes. I was reading a study on height, for example. You think something like height, how tall you are, that's got to be controlled like by one gene. That's actually controlled by like 12 different genes, is how tall you actually get. That's how complex our DNA is and how complex our all of that is. So even though we now have the ability to do this, it's sort of like a caveman finding a computer. And the computer's on and it's connected to the internet, but the caveman has got zero idea about how to use this machine. That's sort of like the stage we're at on that. But we're getting to the point where I think that at some point a lot of mental illness will be able to be treated in that genetic kind of way. So there's biological and anatomical factors that recognize as both physical and mental disorders. For example, we've learned how to cure syphilis of the brain. You know, syphilis is a bacteria that we can cure with antibiotics. Mental disorders is an illness based on brain pathology. It's true that if you give someone a lobotomy, it would dramatically improve their acting out behavior. But do you want to know what a lobotomy is? The way lobotomies were done in the early, really even until the mid 20th century, is they would pull your eyelids out. They would take a surgical instrument, which was basically this long rod with a sharp hook on the end. They would put it up into your prefrontal cortex, which is like right here in your brain, and then they would kind of scramble it like you're scrambling eggs, and then they would pull it out. And people who were really agitated and screaming and very violent and very psychotic suddenly were very docile and very compliant and very agreeable. This is a cure for this disease, right? No. It's not. You know, basically what you're doing is you're taking a big part of what makes us human, which is in our prefrontal cortex, and you're destroying that part. And you're leaving the language comprehension piece of it, but you're also taking away a lot of different abilities to really be who you are, make individual choices and such. So they really don't do lobotomies anymore. They will do certain surgeries for people who have very severe epilepsy, you know, which also can cause mental health issues. Kraepelin, he came up with really one of the first mental disorders identified. And mental disorders are really nothing more than collections of symptoms and collections of observed behaviors that clinicians observed grouping together in certain patients. And so they gave that a label and said, well, when a person has a sad affect and they're down and they're withdrawn, we'll call that depression. And then here's all the different components of that. You know, that's really all these classifications are and what they kind of started out as. Freud's psychoanalytic perspective, he had a comprehensive theory of psychopathology. And his emphasis on interdynamics of the unconscious motives with psychodynamics. And it has its ancestral roots in the study of hypnosis. Hypnosis is still used in some ways in the field of psychology. The truth is that all therapy really is hypnosis on some level. In fact, all conversation is hypnosis on some level. You know, if you think back to your elementary school teachers, you may remember something a teacher said to you offhanded that kind of got in you and stuck with you for a long time. You know, that's really nothing more than what hypnosis is. Hypnosis is just hypnotic suggestions that infect your mind in some ways and then hopefully work to the good and not to the ill. My mom really believed in me. And she was always telling me I was a super genius. And you know, I probably am not a super genius, but I believed I was because mama said I was, right? Kind of like water boy. Mama says such and such, right? Mesmerism, diseases treated by animal magnetism, the source of heated discussion in the early 19th century. There was a lot of hypnosis going on, a lot of work with magnets and all kinds of wacky things that were happening during that period of time. And some evidence it was working, some evidence it was not. The Nancy school was hypnosis and hysteria are related due to suggestion. Hysteria is a form of self-hypnosis. It could be caused and removed by hypnosis, was thought by the Nancy school. The Nancy school and the Charcot debate are mental disorders caused by biological or psychological factors. And of course today, you know, we realize that it's really both in a lot of ways. You know, the biological and the genetic are the foundational components of our behavior. And in fact, in a lot of ways, we're finding more and more that there are actually certain genes and certain genetic factors that we are predispositioned to either certain mental illnesses or certain strengths or certain behaviors. In a lot bigger way than what we once thought were simply environmental causes or psychological factors. Freud's first major step toward understanding psychological factors and mental disorders, he made a big step in that. Whether you love Freud or hate him, one of the things I love about Freud is that he really came up with what's now known as the talking cure. He was the one who invented modern therapy. He invented the thought that if you talk about your emotions, you talk about your feelings, you talk about your history, then your future behavior and your emotions are going to change. And that was a path to a cure. And the truth is, he was right. That was the one thing he was correct about, is that psychotherapy, you know, does work. He wasn't right about a lot of things, but the funny thing, too, is it's kind of coming full range. And there was a point where Freud was totally believed, and that was the predominant paradigm in psychology. Then he was utterly rejected, and then we went into behavioralism, and now we're kind of in the predominant paradigm in psychology is neurology, really, is that everything has a neurological correlate. And it was so funny. I was reading a study, and this was like supposed to be like some really profound thing that they're coming up with, and this neurologist did this complex study. And he was studying brainwave activity and how we make decisions. And he discovered that there is a portion of our brain and our mind that knows what decision we're going to make before we're consciously aware of it, before we even know we're going to make that decision. Freud called that the unconscious. And he discovered it 100 years ago, right? And science is just now catching up with the thought that, yeah, we really do have an unconscious mind, that most of what's happening in our brain is below our threshold of our awareness or our consciousness. It's happening in other ways. Psychoanalysis and treatment had this idea of the catharsis, that if you talk about your problems, you talk about your childhood experiences long enough, you're going to have an emotional release. This was known as the catharsis. And when you had this emotional release, that was a big part of your cure. And in fact, a lot of times when a patient had the catharsis and Freud would be like, well, that's it, you're done, bye. And he would discharge people from therapy. The unconscious was a big part of psychoanalysis, is trying to understand that. And a path to understanding the unconscious was through free association, where you just simply talked. They didn't tell you what to talk about, or they would give you a series of unrelated words, and you tell me the first thing that comes to mind when you hear these words. Mother, sky, dog, Donald Trump, right, whatever. What are the first things that come to mind when you hear these words? And then whatever you said, Freud would say, this came from your unconscious. And then dream analysis, Freud was the first one to really take dreams seriously as a serious set of data that helped to be the pathway to your unconscious mind. I love dream analysis, and I use the Jungian method of dream analysis, which was developed by one of Freud's disciples, Carl Jung. And in my belief system, my theoretical belief system, I think that dreams are a way of your unconscious helping to work out your problems and to give you valuable information about the direction your life either should go, and sometimes give you warnings that your life is going in a direction that you shouldn't be going. And so, you know, a lot of times I'll have clients who come in and they will bring dreams in and want to work with them. And dream content can be a very valuable source of information in therapy if the client is open to that thing, that sort of thing. Some clients aren't, some are. It just depends on the client, but it can be valuable. So experimental psychology, William Wundt was one of the first experimental psychologists, actually did experiments with animals in the laboratory. So the behavioral perspectives is a role of learning in human behavior. We have classical conditioning. You all know probably the famous experiment done by Pavlov and his dogs with salivation and all that. We all have classical conditioned responses of learning that we have all the time. Our traffic system is based purely on classical conditioning. Red, oh, better slow down and stop, right? Green, I better go. Yellow, I better go really fast, right? You know, you got classical conditioning the wrong way. You know? And you're really going big. But that's part of that. If you've ever gotten into your car or you're at home, you turn on the radio, and that certain song comes on, and suddenly, it's 5 years earlier, and you start getting mad because you start thinking, that was the song for that such and such SOB that I dated back then, and that was our song, and I'm going to text him right now, right? And the worst part is after you've had a couple of glasses of wine or a few drinks, and then you drunk text someone. Oh, that's awful. I've made that mistake a few times. And never a good thing. But Pavlov was one of the first ones to talk about classical conditioning. Opera conditioning came out with Thorndike and Skinner. And all opera conditioning is that learning and behavior is simply a result of the consequences of that behavior. If you are rewarded for a behavior, you are more likely to do that same behavior again, right? If reward is withheld or you are punished for that behavior, then sometimes you may be less likely to do a behavior. But what we have found often with humans is that when you punish a human for a certain behavior, they just get better at figuring out how to avoid the punishment, not necessarily doing the behavior. You know, speeding is one of those things, right? You get a ticket for speeding, and often people will go, they don't say, maybe I should slow down and watch my speed, and therefore I won't get a ticket anymore. No, they'll go, I'm going to turn on Waze, and it's going to tell me where the police is. Right? And I'm going to get my radar detector, and then I'll know where they are. And when Waze says it's all clear, I'm going to floor it. You know? And when it says to slow down, police ahead, I'm going to slow down. Right? Anybody use Waze? You know what I'm talking about there? Yeah. It's a big thing now. It's incredible, the apps they have for that kind of stuff. But, yeah, that's a good example of it's not really changing your behavior because you're punished. You're just figuring out how to avoid the punishment. So there's an interpretation of historical events, including biases in the research. There's a lot of controversy over importance and relevance of some historical events and how that all all kind of plays out. We'll get more into this as we get through the semester and talking about treatment and such. But one of the great things that you will discover in mental health treatment and being a therapist is that the more life experience you have, the older you are, the better a therapist you often are. And, you know, when you first start off in the mental health profession, you know, I started off at 28 seeing clients. Let me tell you, I'm 49 now. I'm a much better therapist than I was at 28. You know, I was a pretty good therapist at 28. But in some ways, there were some things that I just didn't get. And it wasn't because I wasn't smart enough to get it. It's just that I didn't have the experience to quite get it yet. And then also, you know, you have more of the gravitas when you are on the witness stand when you're a little bit older than you are when you're younger. When I was first started in my profession and I was in my early 30s, late 20s on the witness stand, almost every time the lawyers would say, "Oh, Dr. Saunders, you seem like you're just starting off in the profession." And I went, "Oh, yeah, I guess I am." You know, as if that gave me less credence to in the jury. Maybe it did, I don't know. Now, of course, you know, I'm so old and decrepit looking that they never say that anymore. I never get that anymore. "Well, Dr. Saunders, you seem like you've been in the profession a long time," is what they usually say now. Yeah. You know, 22 years, a little bit along the ways. So this kind of a opening or beginning. We went over the first couple of chapters tonight in your book. Any questions before we stop tonight? We're stopping a little early. I usually stop around 8:30 because that's about when I give out of steam. But I also watch for yawns, and after the fourth yawn, I usually decide it's time to stop because I'm losing the class. So I will see you guys in a couple weeks. I'll stick around if anybody's got any questions. Otherwise, see you in 2 weeks. Have a great Labor Day, everybody.
Sorry, I actually teach at Valencia.
Oh, okay.
East Campus, I teach history, so I'm coming back to do psychology. So,
oh, wonderful.
But I have class that gets out at 5:15, so I'm trying my best, but 4:08 can be.
I understand.
So I only say that because, like, as a professor myself, I hate moving lights. So
I understand. I mean, the evening classes often are filled with returning adults to college, and everybody's got lives. And
I get that. I teach, and
yeah, I mean, as long as you come in quiet, it doesn't bother.
Okay, cool.
It doesn't
bother. I'm just gonna say that, because, like I said, as a professor, I hate that. So.
Yeah.
All right.
Sure.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
That you evaluate people that are currently becoming cops. Mm-hmm. So what if they failed evaluation? Like, is there something wrong with them?
Sometimes. I mean, it's a pretty high threshold to fail. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got to have a pretty serious mental illness to fail. If they do fail, I don't really say they can't become police officers. My job is just to give the information to the hiring authorities.
I'm just wondering, like, what's the reason, like, if they fail it, does it mean like there's something wrong with them?
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Often it's because they have a diagnosable, serious mental illness that would, you know, put their lives in danger and maybe the lives of the public.
Okay.
And so that's my job, is to try to protect the public.
Makes sense. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I wanted to know, do you research?
Sometimes I do. Yeah, I have a positive psychology research lab. And I think we're due to meet in the next couple of weeks or the beginning of September. So, yeah, if you're interested, just send me an email.
Do you do that here at Valencia?
We actually do meet here.
Yeah. Okay, good, because I live way too far from UCF. And okay. And do you know if this is the only, like, science-related class that meets here in Valencia? Or
I'm not sure. Okay. I'm sure there's more. I'm sure there's more. Yeah, I've taught others. I know next semester I'm teaching physiological psychology, which is the most scientific class I probably teach. So yeah.
Okay, so this is really good. That way I don't have to, like, make that distance.
Okay, well, great.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Out here looking like, okay, I know she has a lot. Okay. My question, because My dad and I were having a conversation, something he said made me think about that. He's like, you have so many issues, why are you trying to be a psychologist? I'm like, there's so many people feel comfortable to come to me with mm-hmm. their issues. So clearly, something I'm saying that's right, why not? And I said, as much as I've gone through, I'm just sharing how I dealt with it.
Basically. Yeah.
But then you said, certain diagnoses can keep you from certain things. Depression isn't one of
them. Oh, I mean, no. I mean, you can be diagnosed with almost anything and still work in mental health. You know, that's not going to keep you from being a mental health professional. Lord, I haven't met a single mental health professional who hasn't gone through something. So that's pretty much the norm.
Okay. And then my other question, because I can't really pinpoint what exactly you do. So you said forensic, you said clinical.
I do a little bit of everything.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I guess this one I would probably say more in email, trying to find the right match of a therapist, because I was going to one. She's like, I'm more of a trauma. So it's like everything I said, she's like, right, and where did you feel that? And I'm like, stop.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I did like four years of therapy myself, you right. know, with five different therapists. And, you know, they all had different perspectives, and it's good to get different perspectives.
It is.
And so, you know, sometimes you just got to have to shop around till you find the therapist that's right for you. Mm-hmm. And not every modality and not every therapist is going to be right for you.
Right. So, I mean, she was a cool person.
Yeah.
Stopping me at every sentence wasn't what I was looking for.
Right. You just want someone who will listen more. So, yeah.
Pretty much. Okay. Well, I'm sure I have 1,000 more questions, but they're waiting, so.
Okay.
We'll save them for next.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
Yeah.
Is it, how can we get involved in it?
There's a couple different ways you can. If you, when do you graduate?
Next year.
Okay. So you could do a directed study, which is a way to get research experience if you wanted to. And that's basically kind of, you would pick a topic, you know, and you would write a research proposal about the study. And then you could, you know, get research credit for that. Mm-hmm. You could go to the main campus or the Orlando campus and talk to the advisors over there. There's a lot of research labs over there that you could get involved with. I run the Positive Psychology Research Lab. So if that's something you're interested in, we actually meet here at the Valencia campus and sometimes at the Claremont campus. So, you know, that's a whole different ball game too, and something you might want to, you know, look at. But there's a lot of different avenues to get involved in it. You just kind of have to ask around and see what opportunities are available. But honestly, the directed study is probably the most straightforward, easiest way to do it. And you can, if you need the credit, you can get like 3 hours credit. Be just like a regular class.
Is that necessary? Like if you want to go to graduate school?
It depends. It just depends. Like if you're going to apply for a PhD in psychology program, that yeah, it really helps you a lot. If you're going to go for, you know, like a master's level social work program or even a licensed mental health program, then probably not. You probably don't need it. You know, in fact, you probably need more of something that might be working in the field, you know, more of a kind of a counselor kind of thing, like a psych tech or like volunteering for the Big Brother, Big Sister program or, you know, something like that might look better on your resume.
Yeah, I do want to get my master's in psychology.
Okay.
So they told me that to have experience in research.
It can help if you're going to go the PhD route eventually or, you're getting, you know, more of the academic part of it. And it depends on what school you go to. You know, if you go to a more professional school that's more of a practitioner-orientated, you know, they may not care about your research experience. But if you go to a school that's more research-oriented, more scholarly-oriented, that, you know, wants you to have that, then, yeah, that's going to matter a lot. So, it just depends on what area, where you're going.
So can we attend to your meetings even though we're not in your research right now, or
can you do what?
Can we attend to your meeting? Like, can I attend to your meeting?
Oh, sure.
Even though I'm not.
Sure.
What days are they?
Send me an email. Okay. I have to see. It kind of changes up. We usually meet like once or twice a month. And I'm not sure when our next meeting is. I have to look at my calendar. I don't have it up right now. But yeah, just send me an email and let me know you're interested. And I will forward your information to the lab director. She's another student who actually kind of manages all that stuff for me. So that might be an avenue for you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. What's your name again?
Daniela Gonzalez.
Daniela.
I'm taking two of your classes.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Nice to see you again. Hey.
I'm Brogan. I think I was in your counseling and interview class.
Okay.
This summer online.
Great.
I was just wondering because you had mentioned that like church a couple times and reading the Jesus book or whatever it was. Like, are you a Christian?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Sweet. So I am too. And I recently got engaged. Mm-hmm. So me and my fiance were kind of looking for, premarital counseling.
Oh, okay.
But more like Christian-based.
Because okay.
Because both of us are believers. So I don't know if you had any like recommendations of like where to go. Because we were thinking about our pastor at our church. Because we really like him. We actually just changed churches. Because I also live in Claremont.
Okay.
Yeah, we went to Real Life for a bit, but then decided to go back to like a smaller church because mm-hmm. it was just getting so big. So we were thinking about him, but I don't know if you have any recommendations or what.
Pastors are always good. Good place to start as far as that goes. You know, if neither one of you have any, you know, real serious mental health issues, mm-hmm. and you're just kind of looking for like the relational stuff. If the pastor, you know, feels equipped to do it and, you know, and has some training in the premarital counseling area, then, you know, that might be just fine. Mm-hmm. I can't do therapy with you while you're a student at UCF at all. Okay. So I don't see anyone at UCF, even if they're not a student in one of my classes, I don't see UCF students. I always refer them out or refer them to someone else because it's just unethical. I'm not allowed to.
Yeah.
There are a number of therapists, though, in Claremont that are Christian-based. Mm-hmm. I have a couple, actually, at my practice. And then there are some that, you know, are around the area. If you Google Christian licensed therapist Claremont, mm-hmm. you'll probably get the Psychology Today listings of everyone who's in that area.
Okay.
That kind of has that look. So I would first look for someone who's licensed. If you don't go through your pastor, then look for someone who's licensed, mm-hmm. and then look for someone who, you know, has experience in couples counseling, and who can do premarital counseling, and then also you want to look for, you know, that they can do Christian counseling.
Mm-hmm.
What most people think of when they think of Christian counseling, often though, is that you just want someone who's going to be you know, non-judgmental and appreciative of your beliefs.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's always comforting to have mm-hmm. As a client. So so that's kind of what I would look for. Mm-hmm. But if you want to call our office, our website is Central Florida Psychology. Mm-hmm. And my person can give you a referral in Claremont. If you call the counseling center, the student counseling center at the Orlando campus, they also have a large directory of therapists all throughout Orlando area that they also could refer you to. You know, sometimes you just have to kind of shop around too to find the right person for you.
Yeah.
But if you already like your pastor, you know, that's not a bad place to start.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, that's all I have.
Fantastic. Well, you have a great night. Uh-huh.
So, my name is Kennedy. So, what do you think about, you know, like I've heard from like therapists and stuff that a lot of going into like a good practice, like into the mental health practice, and you experience mental health issues that it can sometimes like really like kind of trigger you sometimes and stuff. So how do you, like, have you experienced that? Or like, how do you?
You got to do your own therapy.
Right.
And you got to know your own issues.
Right.
Everybody's triggered by stuff on some level. The difference is if you're conscious of your own stuff and you've done your own work and you've done a lot of healing, and honestly, healing's a lifelong process. And so it's not necessarily, I don't know a single mental health professional who entered the profession utterly whole and completely healed and ready to see clients. That's just not, doesn't happen. We all have our own issues and struggles. But the problem, what you want to do is if you're conscious of your own stuff, then you know you're not going to project it onto the client and damage them. So then when you are triggered, you say, okay, this is not about the client. This is about my own stuff. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to react.
Right.
And then I'm going to go get consultation if I need to after this, or maybe even go back into therapy, if I'm triggered that bad. But, that's how you have to handle it.
But it's like a normal thing.
Very normal. Everybody has that. I have colleagues all the time who call me and are like, man, I had this really tough client. It really brought up my stuff. I need to talk about it. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
He's literally calling me right now.
Y'all have a great evening.
If you only do work with psych patients, I call them psych patients, but for the prison, what track should I be looking at if I'm wanting to?
I would look at going into the federal prison system because that's probably, even though they certainly have their own issues, that's probably the best prison system to go into. You can get into that with a master's degree, really. There's a lot of treatment programs that you can get into and become a treatment specialist, or go become a clinical psychologist, get your doctoral degree, and you can have a nice profession in the mental health field and the prison, in that context.
Okay. So not only psychology. So that'd be something different, right?
Not what?
Forensic psychology.
No, I would not get a degree in forensic psychology. I would get a degree in clinical psychology that was APA approved, that you knew was going to lead to your licensure. If you don't get licensed as a licensed psychologist, then your doctoral degree in forensic psychology is going to be useless. If it doesn't lead to licensure. And that's the thing you gotta really, really be careful with, because I have a lot of students who are interested in forensic psychology and they get seduced by a lot of these programs in forensic psychology. I'm not saying that they're bad, if that's what you wanna do, that's fine, it's your life. But if it doesn't lead to some kind of licensure and you're not able to practice in that field, then what's the point of it? It's just an academic degree that might not be, may be useless, except within an academic setting. So I would go the counseling or the clinical field and then specialize in forensic, but have that basis so you can get licensed. That's what you got to do.
Okay.
Whether it's at your master's level or your doctorate level.
I've been trying to figure out which track is going to get me there.
Well, we will talk about that later in the semester too, and I'll kind of go over all the options.
Okay.
Because this class especially, it draws a lot of psych majors that are really looking at going into the field, And so we can talk about that then, and a lot of those questions can be answered then too. But I'll answer them throughout the semester too if you want to, and it's a good profession to be in, and I know for me it's been a real blessing, and you can make money in it to regardless of what everyone else tells you. You're welcome.